Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Dogpile.com. All of these search engines piled into one: Google, Yahoo, Live Search, and Ask.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. In 1970, graduate student Laurel Thatcher Ulrich wrote the following sentence for a scholarly article, quote, "Well-behaved women seldom make history." Today, that phrase can be found on T-shirts, coffee cups, and bumper stickers. In a new book, she explains the origin of the phrase, how different groups have tried to appropriate it, and why history remembers certain women while leaving others behind. Her book is, of course, titled "Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History." And Professor Ulrich joins me in the studio. She is currently the 300th anniversary university professor at Harvard. Her previous book, A Midwife's Tale, won the Pulitzer Prize in History, the Bancroft Prize, and several other awards. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Laurel. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. Tell me how this phrase came into your head.
Oh, I don't know. I felt like it just happened. I suppose I might have had in the back of my mind that phrase, happy love has no history. I mean, sort of the sense, and I was working on an article on Puritan funeral sermons, of all things. The article was called Virtuous Women Found, and I was trying to give these virtuous women a history. And I said, well, you know, they didn't ask to be remembered, and they haven't been. Well-behaved women seldom make history.
And what do you mean, or what did you mean, and what does it mean now when you talk about well-behaved women?
Well, I was thinking about the women that fit the stereotypes of the 17th century. You know, went to church even when it snowed, never spoke up, you know, did the right things, took care of everybody else, didn't want to be noticed. Prayed, read the Bible through once a year, the stereotypical kind of thing that was celebrated in those sermons. And what I say is, when people who really hold up the world, literally, are celebrated, they're idealized into anonymity. They have no history because they have no individuality. They just become icons. And a lot of my work has been devoted to trying to break through those stereotypes and find real women.
And, of course, at Harvard, you have truly found a real woman as president.
Oh, well, it's an amazing. I mean, Harvard, of course, was the Puritan college founded in the 1630s, in part to avoid really scary women like Anne Hutchinson, who was a lay preacher. And one of the reasons of establishing that university was to make sure that educated young men dominated the religious establishment. So we now have, for the first time in Harvard's history, a female president and a historian, I might add, Drew Gilpin Faust, marvelous historian.
Tell me what she's like in terms of her leadership style, her behavior toward the faculty and staff, and students, of course.
Well, of course, she's very, very smart, very balanced. She listens. She does things. I mean, people say, well, she has this female style in that she's a listener. And so then the question is, well, is she strong? Is she strong enough? So I think Drew has faced these stereotypes. If you listen, you're not strong. You know, the kind of dichotomies between good and bad women that plague women in all and have over the centuries. Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
How has the faculty received her?
Oh, very well. I mean, she's well known and people have been so impressed with her innovation, her work prior to that in the Radcliffe Institute, which, think about that. She came in to Harvard directing what had a brand new Institute for Advanced Study, which had grown out of a former women's college, Radcliffe College, now the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. So it's not just that she's a fabulous scholar, but she's a fabulous scholar who came through an institute that came through a women's college.
Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, her new book is titled Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I look forward to seeing your email as well at drshow@wamu.org. Why do you think that that sentence has been sort of appropriated in different ways by different groups? There's a wonderful ambiguity to it.
Yes, and I'm sure the ambiguity has a lot to do with it. I mean, it could mean, as I implied in that early article, well, good girls get no credit. But then a younger generation sort of loves the notion bad girls have no more fun. And as undergraduates tell me, you know, it's an excuse for all kinds of misbehavior, and they love this. But I've been really touched by the fan mail I get. I mean, this is a strange experience for an academic to be getting fan mail for a sentence. And I, you know, I hear for people who are involved in good causes like raising money for breast cancer research or midwifery services or aid to the homeless. One of the most amazing responses I got was just last week. Somebody wrote that they had seen the book in Borders and immediately bought it because they had previously had the bumper sticker in the t-shirt and had actually, this is sort of amazing given the origins of my words, put this on their mother's tombstone.
My God.
And I was just so touched by that. But it was a sense, you know, this woman wasn't perfect. We loved her. And we won't forget her.
It's interesting that the book should come out at this time when in our presidential campaign, one has a very strong woman running for the Democratic nomination, and perhaps a great many people might say that on the one hand, Hillary Clinton is too strong. On the other hand, they might say, well, she put up with too much.
Oh, yes. And we've seen this in the press. We've seen it in op-ed pieces, in responses. I mean, it's that same dichotomy. When she is good, she is very, very good. And when she is bad,
she's
makes
horrid.
History.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
I guess. One of the things I think's interesting about the Hillary Clinton race, though, if you think of identity politics and how it works in our society, these two candidates, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and I think it's fascinating and really a mark of historical change that they're being talked about in terms of the least experienced and the most experienced candidate. And it's a female candidate who is, well, we may or may not like her, but she's experienced. And that's new, because I think a lot of women in the past who've run for major political office have come very much on the coattails of their husbands. One could argue that that is the case for Hillary, except that she's been such a presence from day one.
Exactly.
This is not, you know, the quiet widow succeeding, you know, the governor who died too young or something like that.
Now, do you believe that your sentence has helped change people's minds about women and their behavior?
I don't know, but I'm sure it's reinforced lots of interesting things. It's fun to see. One of the interesting responses that I got was from a woman who runs a quilting store. And she created a whole line of products, specially printed fabric, a little leash that goes around your neck to hold your scissors so you don't lose them. And I said, this is really strange. You know, I don't think of quilters as misbehaving. And she said, well, yes, they really are salt of the earth types, but they like to think of themselves as a little outrageous and out of control in the pursuit of their hobby. And I sort of love that image.
Yeah.
You know, be out of control in the pursuit of something, and something that you consider valuable and good. And so I love the sense, even though I had no idea I was creating a slogan, for heaven's sakes, that I love the idea that people have found it fun and empowering.
And, of course, the slogan is the title of Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's new book. It is Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History. We'll take a short break. I know many of you would like to talk with Laurel. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Welcome back. Here's an early email for Laurel Thatcher Ulrich on her book, Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History. It's from Barb, who says, I want to thank Dr. Ulrich deeply for her saying, I bought shirts, bumper stickers, and pins at the Missouri History Museum for myself and my friend Peggy. Wearing them makes us feel a little stronger when we're threatened or when we need to look to the future.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I hope it also gives you some incentive to look to the past. When I think most people, when they see the slogan, they think about what the kind of history they're going to make. One of the themes of the book is that many of us who helped to recover women's history beginning in the 1970s, were empowered by discovering there had been other women before
exactly.
us.
And you focus particularly on the lives of three women, one of whom is Virginia Woolf.
Yes. You know, everyone has to read A Room of One's Own in order to understand the complexities of women in history. And it was really exciting to go back to that again, to think about its significance at the time, 1929, but then to think about its recovery in the 1970s and 80s and how some of the things Woolf wrote about have been revised and rewritten about by other people today.
Do you think that she was breaking the rules at the time?
Oh, well, definitely. In terms of her fiction, I mean, one of the things that's most remarkable about her, in addition to her innovations in prose, but she was intrigued with the invisible, the unknown, exactly the theme, I think, of the slogan, the people who are forgotten, the roast on the table with the family around it, the rowboat to the lighthouse, the interior experience of people, men and women, concerned as well about the violence in ordinary life and war and living in a world of war and suffering, and yet our kind of immunity to those things. So Woolf opened up many, many themes that were picked up in the so-called second wave feminism in the 1970s and 80s, and Woolf herself was revived. People had earlier, when I was an English major 100 years ago as an undergraduate, she was not part of the canon.
Interesting.
Yes.
And then slowly, her work began to be revived and appreciated.
Absolutely. It came
back. And another woman you talk about who behaved in a very different way, and she was not well behaved in a very different way, was Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
Right. It was fun for me to compare Woolf and Stanton and an earlier medieval woman, Christine de Pizan, three women who really were stimulated to transform women's lives and women's history by getting mad in libraries. I mean, sitting at the received wisdom around them, three different centuries, three different countries, three different situations, and yet they wanted to talk back to those books that said women could only do certain things or act in certain ways.
And, of course, they did not totally restrain themselves when they were talking in public. I mean, Elizabeth Cady Stanton hardly restrained herself.
No, she did not. And she even outraged her fellow women's rights activist when she decided to rewrite the Bible. I mean, she said getting the vote is one thing, but, you know, we've really got to go to the root of the problem.
Talk about Christine de Pizan, because she was, as you said, a poet, a scholar. She was at the French court. She was born in 1365. Why does she become such an important figure in your mind as relates to this book?
Well, she's important because of her contribution to women's history, arguably the first major work in women's history in Western culture, 1405, The Book of the City of Ladies. But also important because she, too, was lost and forgotten. The first English translation of her work was in the early 1500s. Queen Elizabeth probably had a copy, but then it was forgotten and brought back in 1982 was the second English translation, and it came again from this quest of women to find their history. Natalie Davis, Charity Willard, and others recovered the life of Christine.
You write that notions of good behavior vary from place to place, and they change over time as the proper role of women in society has become more nebulous. How would you describe the well-behaved woman of today?
Oh, my goodness. I think, you know, what I hear from young women today is a lot of confusion about that. And I suppose for educated women, it's the woman who has it all. That overburdening notion that you're going to be everything to all people in all times, you know, succeeding in a career, succeeding in a family, and so on. Which is overpowering sometimes. And then there are the other versions of good behavior that are more traditional. And what do you do when these two ideas come up against each other?
That is the question. It seems to me that young women today have a wonderful opportunity because of longevity, that in fact women can have it all, but maybe not all at the same time.
Oh, I agree very much. And when I talk to these tired young mothers or exhausted graduate students, I say, how old are you? You know, life is long. And I think we really have to appreciate that. There are so many ways to contribute. And this is true for young men as well. I would not say anything different to a young man.
All right, let's open the phones now. 800-433-8850. Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio, and to Bob. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Probably one of the most unbehaved women of our time is Ann Coulter. And the thing that surprises me is it seems the people that are most against her are the intellectuals in our society, the intellectual elites, who you would think on the college campuses would, you know, welcome other opinions, but just seem to, you know, they're just very limited. They don't want to seem to explore other opinions. It's become almost like Harvard was at the beginning, where they're only going to have a certain type of person, you know, being able to participate in the discussion, and they exclude all others. That's my comment.
Bob, let me ask you something. Have you been in an audience where Ann Coulter has spoken?
Well, I've watched, I know there's one clip where she's on a college campus,
uh-huh.
And she's hit with a pie.
Huh.
You know, and she's, you know, shouted down and things like that. And it just seems, you know, to me, it seems on a college campus, that's where you would want open discussion, you know, different ideas presented, you know, put up for a discussion.
Well, and, the other question might be not only what she's saying, but the manner in which she's saying it.
Well, what are you saying that you, to come to a college campus, you have to, I mean, what, I've seen her give talks and things like that. And by the way, I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton in the next election. I'm just saying it's very disappointing. I've seen her give talks on college campuses, and I've seen her present herself on, you know, media shows and things like that, you know, like an internet clip.
Sure. Laurel, do you want to comment?
Well, I can't, because I have to confess I've never heard her. But I will say that she's probably gotten a lot of attention and a lot of success by being not well-behaved. I mean, in some ways, this really demonstrates the point. People who act out, and people who act out do it constructively or not constructively, but they tend to get press attention.
Well, that's absolutely true in her case. Let's go to Jackson, Michigan. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning. I'm glad to be on your show today and be able to ask a question about the woman who started UNICEF. Her name was Gabriela Mistral, and she was from Chile but died here in the United States. Towards the end of her life, she gave a cry out to the world to help the women and children throughout the world. And today she is completely forgotten. Even though she won the Nobel Prize for Poetry, her books are not in the libraries the way they should be. And I know that she published something called Lectures for Women, which was published in Spanish. And my question is, could her writing at that time have influenced the women who are now presidents in Argentina and Chile?
Interesting.
Boy, I wish I had an answer to that, but I think probably so. And you've done a great thing by bringing her name to the attention of the public, and it's an example of the thousands of people who've done great things that we don't know about and don't remember. So thanks for reminding me of that. She's not in my book, alas. But maybe. If there's a sequel,
exactly,
maybe she will be.
Exactly. Thanks for calling, Andrew. Let's go to Janet in O'Sallan, Illinois. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. I think of Alice Paul as being one of the women that has really been left out of history. While certainly we owe our voting rights a great deal to the women who came before her, Alice Paul did a great deal to actually succeed in getting women our voting rights. But she's really been left out of history, and it's always been rumored that it's because she was militant. And I wondered if your guest agrees with that, and also that perhaps women are responsible for keeping her out of history.
That's very interesting, Janet. Let me, before you respond, just remind our listeners at 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Laurel, that's such an interesting point. Are women themselves responsible for keeping some, perhaps more militant women out of history? Go right ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I would say Alice Paul is in history, but you see, I'm in a university, and my students know about Alice Paul and Carrie Chapman Catt and Elizabeth Cady Stanton's daughter, all of whom were part of the militant suffrage movement. And I like them to know that it was young women, college women, who changed the focus of the fight for the vote using automobiles, using militant tactics that probably scared people to death so that they were willing to listen to the somewhat more conservative by that period, by 1910, 1912, women. So there's popular history, there's scholarly history, and I do think Alice Paul, however, is somewhat celebrated in the headquarters of the Women's Party, which is up beyond the Capitol in Washington, D.C. There's a great little lapel pin you can buy there that shows a jail gate. I mean, these are women who went to jail in order to win the vote. They made history, and remembering them is our job, of course.
Thanks for calling, Janet. Do you think Hillary Clinton's bid for the presidency is a form of misbehavior that might draw the sort of approbation of women themselves?
Boy, I wish I were an expert on contemporary politics and could answer that in any way other than just, you know, as a citizen. But as I think about it historically, there have been women running. I think the very first woman to run for president was in 1872, if I'm not mistaken, Victoria Woodhull. Who was a very outrageous, misbehaving woman by the standards of her time. But most women, I think, who have run for president have done it as protest candidates. supporting some kind of particular cause, or perhaps favorite daughters, Margaret Chase Smith from Maine. This is really important because Hillary Clinton encompasses three interesting political identities: First Lady, Senator, and then major presidential candidate. And bringing those three things together, it sort of reinforces what I was saying earlier about her as experienced. It's fascinating that her experience as First Lady is counted for those who like her and support her as a very positive political experience, whereas I would think in earlier periods it would be, oh, that would be the last kind of experience anyone would count as being politically significant.
And yet, just last week, I mean, you heard this talk of piling on.
Oh, yes.
Hillary.
Yeah.
So it almost was though she wanted it both ways.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a tough situation, and I think it what happens in this particular campaign is probably a lot less about Hillary than it is about what's happened in the general society.
And especially to women.
Yes.
Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, and her new book is titled Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, golf's bad boy, John Daly. He doesn't have an exercise regimen. He begins his day with a Diet Coke and a cigarette and has battled addictions to alcohol and gambling. But he sure can play. He's won two of golf's most prestigious tournaments. He has a memoir and a new book called Golf My Own Damn Way. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And here's a response to that question about Ann Coulter. Yeah. It's from Jim in Lexington, North Carolina, who says there's a difference between making history and just making noise. Ms. Coulter is just making noise. That's his opinion. Let's go back to the phones, 800-433-8850, and to Miami, Florida. Mitra, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, ladies. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. I lecture and I teach on Islamic cultures and Islamic feminism, where really in that society, the culture, you know, restriction put just not by men, but more importantly by other women, forces the women to behave in a particular manner, that you have to be nice to make it to the top. So My question was, has the author examined the way the Muslim world and how it differs from the West? And if she hasn't, shouldn't the title be, if I may be so bold, I apologize, should it be like perhaps how to make it in the Western world? Because in the East, you really have to behave a certain way.
Am I on the air?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Oh, what a good question. Is this culturally, does this culturally vary across time? And the answer, of course, is yes. And definitions of good behavior vary across time. This comment that I made was very specific to a time and place in the early 1600s in Massachusetts. And then it got taken out of my mouth, out of my pen, and turned into a popular slogan. It's interesting, though, the Muslim woman from India, now I'm going to embarrass myself not being able to remember her name, who placed at Wimbledon, probably our caller knows who she is, a young woman from South Asia, the first South Asian woman to rank in the top 40 in tennis. She sort of amazed people when she came to Wimbledon wearing a T-shirt with this slogan.
Yeah.
And the idea was she was having it both ways, being devout but playing tennis and sort of facing down those in her own society who thought she was being immodest to do so.
We'll try to get that name a little later in the program. Here's an email from Ryan, who says, how did the slogan get from an essay to popular culture?
Oh, that's an important story, and thanks for asking that question. It just sort of sat there in, you know, the library for almost 20 years. And then along came a wonderful journalist, Kay Mills, who was writing a popular book on women's history. And she did her homework. She read a lot. And by then, I was a little better known, and my work as well. And she stumbled across my essay. And it was Kay Mills who picked that sentence out of my article and used it as an epigraph in her own book, which was called From Pocahontas to Power Suits. And then someone else picked it up, probably from Kay, and put it in a book of quotations. And then a young woman, entrepreneurial spirit named Jill Portugal, found it in her roommate's copy of this book of quotations. And she emailed me and said, can I put it on T-shirts?
Oh, how wonderful. How wonderful. Here's an email from Angela, who says, Laurel, are you a well-behaved woman?
Oh, well, it depends on who you ask, I suppose. And I think that would be true for all of us. When I stand up for something that I believe in, some people think I'm not well-behaved and in the workplace or in other situations. Other people looking at me thinking, you look pretty well-behaved to me. I mean, still married to the same man after almost 50 years, you know, mother, college professor, you know, dowdy dresser, whatever. So it's all in the eyes of the beholder.
Do you think so? Or does some of it come from within? I mean, some of us are true rebels, and we know it.
We know it. Maybe we're third children, whatever. We're the
or
people.
Second children, whatever. But rebellion may be part of that notion of misbehavior, that standing up to what one perceives as unfair authority.
I think
may be seen as misbehavior.
Yeah, I think these things are internal. I think they're also created in experience in society. I mean, people who never expected, to stand up, never expected to go to jail, never expected to stand on a platform. And you would even think of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who describes herself as a rebel from childhood, and yet she was terrified when she gave her first speech.
Yeah, there's that dichotomy as well. Let's go to Orcas Island, Washington. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning to you. I've been desperately looking for some books for my soon-to-be 10-year-old granddaughter, because it's become clear to me that she has no sense of women's history at all. I mean, I know a lot has been lost, but for her, there is none in the first place. So I was wondering if there was anything you could recommend for her.
Oh, my goodness. I think there are a lot of things out there, and I'm going to be stumped at the moment to try to come up with a list. Maybe we can create one and put it online, or that would be a fun thing to do.
I think that would be a great thing to do, and especially keeping in mind young people.
Young people. I think there need to be more and better ones. It was interesting. I was talking to one of my students the other day who had grown up on Little House on the Prairie, which my children read every one of those volumes. And she said she was shocked. She went back and started reading one of those volumes and realized how racist one of the sections was. And she hadn't recognized it at all. As a child, it was about blackface and minstrels and some of the language. And that's all right. I think people can learn that books change and values change over time. But, you know, Little Women, I grew up on Little Women, which is full of a rebellious person who gets tamed down at the end. So this whole question of children's literature is a fascinating one, but one I'm not an expert on, unfortunately.
All right. Kathy will try to get that list from Laurel and get that up on our website. Let's go to Elizabeth in Rochester, New York. Good morning. You're on
the air.
Hi.
Laurel, I just wanted to let you know, well, I have a question too, but as a single parent, I've looked for ways of being home with my daughter and making a living and going from a professional career to home life. It's been very traumatic in some ways because I was always told I could do whatever I wanted to do. But when I saw your quote, I immediately put it on my eBay store as a title, and not to my store, but just as an extra quote, as well as I put it up there with Martin Luther King Jr.'s quote, "Human salvation lies in the hands of the creatively maladjusted."
Huh.
And it's funny because I interpret your quote and his quote in a certain way, and I think it's interesting that other people, when they've read mine, might think of it, you know, in terms of total misbehavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, from my perspective, the way I looked at it and when I heard it and really how I feel very strongly about that, is that we women have been expected to behave, and we could never have achieved anything, even, you know, conquering the things that we feel really strongly about without in terms of what we are perceived as in the general public population or throughout history. We had to be looked at as misbehaving because you went against the grain.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I guess I went in writing this book very much from the theme of misbehavior, which I say over and over again changes. It really does change over time with perception and with society, with transformations in society. I shifted from that to the question of what it means to make history. And I agree with the caller who said it's not just about making noise or getting attention. History is the study of how things change. And if there's no deviation from the perceived norm, there's no change. And I think the important thing, you know, people who see new possibilities are people who bring about change. And they often have to push against the advice or of others or the restrictions or the laws, the actual legal restrictions on their behavior. There are so many amazing stories of this. Now, let me give you one, because I think history is informative. If we think of the anti-slavery movement in the early 19th century, we think of tremendous courage to stand up against injustice. But some of the most courageous people came at that out of those who were not enslaved, who were comfortable, who had no reason to fight this institution, came out of it out of their own sort of good behavior. These were people who were used to raising funds for the ministers or the ladies in the church society. And they came to the anti-slavery movement out of their good behavior, and their good behavior led to bad behavior, quote unquote. That is, they got in big trouble because they went from, you know, raising money to buy shirts for the minister to signing petitions to Congress. And there are some wonderful stories about what that meant to those people and how that transformed their lives when they took the risk to bring about change in the world. And I suppose if I had any goal in my scholarship, in my teaching, in this little book that I've written, it would be to get people to think about change and how it happens and why it matters.
And do you see women at the forefront of that change?
I hope so. That's what I want to see.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Tiffany in Yardley, Pennsylvania, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you so much for the opportunity to speak on your show.
Sure.
Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, thank you so much for writing this book. I'm actually in the middle of it. I happened to discover it in Barnes & Noble one day. And I consider myself a very strong feminist. I love the suffrage movement. Elizabeth Cady Stanton is one of my personal heroes because I'm a stay-at-home mother of three. And I, on a daily basis, am fighting to teach my daughter and the women around me about what it is to be a woman. My comment today, or my question, is what do you see in the future for the young women and teenage girls who are growing up today? Because as a woman, I am very concerned about what I see the misbehaviors of women today.
What do you mean?
I mean culture, not necessarily in the respect that your book talks about. But I see the images that are being portrayed in young women through pop culture. And I also feel that women are losing a sense of what the suffrage movement was about. You know, I feel like we're so far past that women don't see that, you know, there was a time when we really had to struggle for these things, and they're taking them for granted.
Thanks a lot for your comment. I think lots of us share those concerns. And let me put in a little plug for Jill Portugal, who got this whole slogan going with her T-shirts. I mean, she was just a young single woman wanting to start a little business. But she was really concerned by exactly the thing you're talking about. And she went back to school. She's now a school guidance counselor and a mother. She's so concerned about young people. And she has a website called One Angry Girl Designs, which sells the slogan, a variation of the slogan. She likes the word rarely better than the word seldom in the slogan. But she is fighting pornography, sexual harassment, trivialization of women's bodies. She's very concerned about the youth culture and also what she calls fascist beauty standards. She wants more variety in what young people consider beautiful in their lives.
But Tiffany also talks about behavior.
Yes.
And modeling.
Yes.
And the notion that, for goodness sake, someone like Paris Hilton becomes a role model for these young kids because they see her in pretty clothes and cameras on her. And so they yearn for not authenticity, but celebrity.
Yes, yes. What a difference. What a distinction. And it's so important. And that's why we need these models there, not just historical models, but contemporary models of people that are doing amazing things in their lives. I mean, I love the autobiography of Wangari Maathai, the green belt woman from Nigeria who received the Nobel Prize. What a wonderful image that would be.
Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, she's professor at Harvard. Her new book is titled Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History. Thank you so much for joining us. Good to talk with you.
Was fine. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.